Madam Chair, at this time, you have a quorum. I'd like to call roll. Larry Bush. Robert Carlson.
Present.
Kristen Chu.
Present.
Kevin Hughes.
Present.
Ryan Larkin.
Here.
Brenda McNulty. Alexander Tonneson.
Here.
Item 2, opportunity for the public to comment on any matters within the committee's jurisdiction that are not on the agenda.
Seeing none.
Item 3, approval with possible modification of the minutes of the September 18th, 2017 meeting.
Our esteemed leader is a little under the weather today, so I will be attempting to run parliamentary procedure on this meeting with Brenda, with Mara's help. Does anybody have any comments on the minutes? Is there a motion?
I move approval of the minutes.
I second.
Any public comment? Thank you. It's a team effort here, really, to keep this meeting going. Thank you. Seeing no public comment. Are we all in favor?
Yes.
Aye.
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 Let's move on to the next item.
Item 4, presentation from the Mayor's Office of Housing regarding the 2015 affordable housing bond and possible action by the committee in response to such presentation.
Committee members, Kate Hartley in the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development. We are pleased to be before you today to give you an update on the 2015 housing bond. As you recall, the housing bond was separated into four categories of expenditures: $80 million for public housing, $100 million for low-income housing, $50 million for low-income housing specifically in the Mission, and $80 million for middle-income housing. And it's in some cases very self-descriptive, but we really wanted to serve vulnerable populations for whom housing resources are too scarce, and as well as middle-income housing. So we're middle-income households. So we're serving those middle-income residents of San Francisco, as well as veterans, seniors, and low-income working families. We're pleased to report that 70% of the first issuance is encumbered. We also had really great demand for our middle-income down payment assistance loan, which is fully subscribed. We're making good progress on the other categories of expenditures. At Potrero, our first development is underway. We're thrilled about that. This is a HOPE-SF development to transform public housing that has been in the works since about 2007. So it was a great milestone to actually start construction on the first development. At Sunnydale, it's a little farther behind, but we expect to break ground on the first development in January of 2018. For our low-income new construction housing developments, each one of them is well underway for pre-development. We do want to talk in a second about reallocating some of the Prop A funds that we had originally identified to go to two developments, which hit development issues that are going to delay them. And because we want to spend the bonds as quickly as possible, we're going to just shift the developments to which those Prop A funds will go. Our small sites program is also going really well, and as you recall, this is a program where we lend money so that nonprofit developers can buy rent-controlled housing that is at risk of conversion to market rate, preserve the housing, stabilize the affordability, make it permanent, and allow people to stay in San Francisco who otherwise might have to move away. And as I mentioned, our down payment assistance loan program and teacher next door programs are going really well. For the middle income new construction, the production side, we have two developments that we're thrilled about. Also, teacher housing at 43rd and Irving, and also a component of the 88 Broadway development, which will be for a reserve for middle income households, in addition to other units there, which will be for low-income households, and we also have senior housing at 88 Broadway. So the reallocation at 4840 Mission, as you may have read about in the bond report that we submitted, an opportunity came up with the parcel next door. And there was a chance by partnering with that owner to increase the amount of affordable housing, increase the amount of housing overall, and also provide the neighborhood with a brand new renovated Safeway. And so we thought that it was an opportunity that would confer enough benefits that we were willing to slightly delay that development in order to create a new, broader, more beneficial development. And so we would like to move the Prop A funds that were allocated to 4840 Mission over to 88 Broadway, which is well on track to start construction but before the end of next year, and which is already receiving Prop A bond funds for its middle-income housing component. So the use of the Prop A bond funds will be the same. It's just going to another development that won't delay the expenditure of the bond funds. As well, 250 Laguna is going slower than we had hoped, largely because it needs to complete an EIR based upon historical resources at the site. And so that's a senior housing development, as you recall. We have another senior housing development that is scheduled to start construction in the first quarter of 2018 called 1296 Shotwell. And so we want to use the Prop A bond funds for senior housing at that site. In addition, because of the demand for the down payment assistance loan program funds, which far exceeded supply, we are considering moving those funds that were previously scheduled for new unit production to down payment assistance loan funding. The production costs for middle-income housing are quite high on a per unit basis because there's no federal or state funds with which we can leverage our money. And so the city essentially has to pay the full freight of the cost of those besides some mortgage debt that those funds can produce. So it's very difficult to finance, and it's actually more cost effective. We're seeing now in this high cost environment to use the funds for a down payment assistance loan for which there's great demand. But we'll be back to you as we continue the analysis of that change. And with that, I would like to, unless you have questions that you'd like to ask now, turn over the mic to my colleague to talk about the 2016 Seismic Safety Loan Program. Repurposing, essentially, another bond that we now have the ability to use in a broader way from which it was originally intended in 1992, I believe.
Hey, Anson, do we want to talk about this first, right?
Yeah, okay. I had a couple of questions.
Okay, let's do that.
Hi. They were on page 4, the low-income housing slide. The money that was allocated to, was it, where are you going to transfer? Is it, it's Laguna Honda and
it's,
and 4840 Mission.
Right.
And previously, I think that money had been committed or encumbered with a developer.
Yes.
So how does, is there any problem? Are you going to, you're going to take all that money away from those developers and then give it to these new two projects? How does that work?
Yeah, sorry. Thank you for the opportunity to clarify that. We have issued pre-development loans. That was part of the first issuance. We're not taking that away. They're moving forward with their pre-development work. But it's the gap funding, the large infusion of construction funds that is in the neighborhood of $21 million for each of those sites that we'll be allocating to the new projects. So the money that's been encumbered for these developments will stay in place, and it's a great use of the bond funds. The pre-development's well underway. It's the construction funding that we're going to move.
So maybe next time you have an overall budget, maybe you could show that.
Sure.
Transfer, so it's
yeah,
kind of clear, because it's kind of hard to follow unless
yes,
you see that.
I agree. And in our, there is a better table in our bond report on pages 27 and 28.
Oh, okay, that might do it, because we just got that. We just got that this morning.
Oh, so okay.
Didn't have a chance to read
okay.
that.
Okay, it's laid out there pretty well, but we're happy to revisit it.
That might do it, for
All
sure.
All right, thank you.
Okay, and then also on the next page, the middle-income housing, you have small sites, but I didn't see any budget for small sites in middle-income housing. Should that be under low-income?
Yes. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. That was a mistake. We just noticed that we got that wrong today. Small sites is in our low-income category. The reason that we accidentally put it into middle-income is unlike the other low-income developments, which cap occupancy at households earning just 60% of area median income, the small sites program can go up to 120% of area median income. So it serves a much broader purpose and can serve many more households. But it's still the buildings that our nonprofit partners have bought tend to serve low-income people. So it's kind of a tweener there. But, yes, thank you. That's a correction.
All right, just one more question on the reallocation of future issuances. And it may be explained in the bond report, but taking the money from 4840 Mission and 250 Laguna Honda and putting it into 1296 Shotwell and 88 Broadway, will that keep the number of units generated equal, less than, or more than what had previously been identified for the
The projection for 4840 and 250 Laguna was 264 units. The number of units that we will serve just for seniors at 88 Broadway is 96. And I'm sorry, seniors at 1296 Shotwell, there's 96 units there, and 104 family units at 88 Broadway. So the number is going down slightly.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Please.
Yeah, Kate, I had two questions. The first is about the mechanics of the reallocation. Brenda Quee McNulty and I are liaisons. I guess I'm the liaison for the Muni bond, the 2014 municipal railway and street repairs. Anyway, they, at our last meeting with them, liaison meeting with them in September, said that they had to do some reallocation for something that seemed less extensive than what you're doing, and they had to go to the Board of Supervisors to get approval. Did you have to go to the Board of Supervisors for this?
No, we submitted essentially a request to reallocate to the Comptroller's office, and because the use of the funds is exactly the same from one development to the other, the Comptroller advised us that we did not have to go to the Board of Supervisors to get that approval, because what we anticipated doing, we are still doing. Mm-hmm. It's just changing the development name.
Like I said, it's with the Muni one, and this has nothing to do with you, I guess it's a conversation I should be having with Ben Rosenfeld, is that they seem to think that just changing, reallocating money, I think, from one project to the next, one bus line to the next, they needed to go back to the Board of Supes. Yours, does, like I say, seems at least as extensive as that. So maybe they could save themselves some trouble.
Or the opposite. I mean, I have concerns about this. This is a significant change. What governance do we does the bond write in for that? And you know, I mean, what is in our purview is what the voters are expecting.
So what I don't know about the Muni. Would you like to speak to it? Yes, Benjamin would like to speak.
I would love to try. Hi, Benjamin McCloskey, Deputy Director for Finance and Administration for the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development. Whether or not the board needs to approve a change really depends on what the board approved the first time around and what level of specificity the board approved the first time around. I'm not familiar with the MTA bonds, but in our case, the board approved allocations just in those buckets of public housing, low-income housing, middle-income housing, and the set-aside for the Mission. They didn't identify specific projects in their board resolution. And since we're staying within those buckets, there's nothing really for the board to change in the resolution itself. I'm not sure perhaps the MTA resolution had more specificity in what the board approved, and that may be what's triggering them to need to go back to the board.
Maybe, you know.
Well, I think that there's two. One is what actually was the law and what did they say, and the other one is what was the understanding of the voters, what has been communicated to our community. So I don't want to just say, oh, they don't have to because it wasn't written down that way.
Right.
I want to be really as transparent as we can.
Yeah.
I think it is important to make these important changes as you go along. I'm not against, you know, using the funds in the most efficient way possible, mm-hmm. given our crazy housing market here. I just want to make sure that, you know, again, our purview is what the voters intended with these funds and what the voters are expecting from these funds.
And this seems
like a pretty big shift from there. And so I think.
Well, and I think that may also be a distinction. Again, I'm not familiar with what the voters approved in the MTA bonds. But in the housing bonds, there were never, when the voters voted, there were no specific projects identified at all. There were just these buckets. And perhaps in the MTA situation, maybe there was something different.
Well,
I will, this is Peg Stevenson from the controller's office. Ben is on vacation this week. I'm acting for him. I will check on the MTA, but it's probable that it's budgetary control at the project level that was the issue. And so there are rules governing the allocation after the Board of Supervisors has approved the appropriation ordinance. And so I'm guessing that's what was involved, but I'll check and be sure.
Could you do that?
Good morning.
A bunch of trouble. Go ahead.
I'm Vishal Trivedi from the Office of Public Finance, the Controller's Office. Just to offer a little bit of clarification, what's been presented today for the housing bond, that is a change in the plan going forward for future issuances of this bond. So the voters have authorized the funds to be spent on certain categories of projects, and they're just fine-tuning what the plan is going forward. The MTA is a slightly different situation, as Ms. Stevenson just said. I can confirm.
I get it.
Those funds had already been appropriated. Yep. It was a previous issuance.
But take MTA off the table completely. Yeah. We're making a significant change to millions and millions of dollars of voter-approved funding.
Right.
So regardless of what the MTA is doing, I just want there to be some governance associated with this. I want there to be some transparency associated with this. Sorry, there's been plenty, that people know about this bond, whatever we talked about it in what they voted for has also been supplemented with additional information about what, you know, the plans are. So we're making changes to the plan. So I think the question for me is what governance, whether that's a board of supervisors or something else. I just want to make sure that the governance is in these decisions is being made and it is transparent.
I just wanted to clarify that was what triggered the MTA. They had
sure.
to go for a new ordinance to reappropriate the money.
Sure.
And that answers my question as well as it's going to get answered today. One other question, again, for Kate. I think it was last year you provided us, or your office provided us, a report. And I thought I had that one with me, but I have a different one. But in it, you described the availability, the qualifications for the low-income housing program. And it had a pretty detailed description of how what I'll call residency requirements, you know, for how long you would have had to have been in the system in order to qualify for that program. And I guess it was about this time last year, maybe more like September, October last year, I went back and forth with someone from the Chronicle, an editor of the Chronicle, about something that I had said based on a quote from your report. And they came back to me and said, oh, we checked with Jeff Kaczynski at the mayor's, pardon me, at the office of the Department of Housing and Supportive Housing, Homelessness and Supportive Housing, said, oh, no, what you said, again, a quote from the report, was incorrect. I will try to find that report, and I'll try to get back to you with it and see if I can get the disparate descriptions of what those qualifications, what those requirements were, resolved, because even after I read what Kaczynski's office said and what yours office said, I didn't understand what the requirements were. It seemed pretty arcane, but, you know, that's me.
So this is for the homeless set-aside that we do in most of our buildings. It's not for the 80% of the low-income residents, the working low-income residents who reside in our buildings. The eligibility criteria specifically for the homeless households in our buildings we got from homelessness and supportive housing. So I know that they're moving to a coordinated entry system now.
Yes.
That's part of the change. So it's possible that there was stale data that we had from their office because they are moving towards they are now in coordinated entry, but we'll be happy to get you exactly their eligibility criteria for homeless households.
And you know, if I could get your contact information, I'll forward you the email chain that went back and forth among the three parties to this here, and that should make it easier for you to understand than understand what I'm telling you now.
I that would be great, and there's no reason to doubt what you're saying, and it's possible that there was some misinformation based upon a change in criteria going to a new coordinated entry, but basically we work with homelessness and supportive housing. They dictate the terms of eligibility for the local operating subsidy program units, and we defer to their criteria.
Okay. And it may have been just as you said. But anyway, I'll if I get your contact information, I'll forward that stuff, and we'll get it resolved.
Okay. Thank you.
If I might, Kate, thank you for the information. I have a couple of questions on the movement of the money from 4840 Mission and 250 Laguna to the other sites. And I understand that it's a no change in use and that it's inside the scope of the ballot measure. And so what I would like to ask about the 4840 Mission location and the 250 Laguna Honda location is that the pre-development money has been allocated and is being used, and that what moved was the construction funding. And what I'm curious about is where does that leave these two projects going forward for 4840 Mission and 250 Laguna Honda? Are there dollars left inside the bond? If not, and I understand that there may be a collaboration with an adjacent property owner that provides additional below market rate or affordable units as a result of that collaboration. But how does the hole created by the movement of the construction funds get filled? And that's my question.
We have other sources of funds besides the Prop A bond. We have inclusionary fees, jobs housing linkage fees, and housing trust fund monies. And so we're not at all putting the construction funding for those two developments at risk. We have just reallocated funds. So 4840 and 250 Laguna will be funded by inclusionary or jobs housing linkage. And there's no gap for them. But we want to get the bond funds spent quickly. And so that's why we wanted to shift to developments of the same type, the same eligible uses that could use the funds as fast as they can.
Thank you.
So we can move on to the other section. For my colleagues, I just wanted to note that on the sheet that says the upcoming bond issuances, that this is intended to go out for another bond issuance in the March-April timeframe for $82 million. So in our role as making sure that these we feel that the funds are being spent in accordance with the bond.
Good morning. My name is Adam Cray. I run the conduit issuance program for the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development, and I've also been tasked with running point on the 2016 housing bond issuance as well. I'd like to just provide a little bit of background here in terms of the issuance authority and funding terms for the bond. Oh, I'm going the wrong way there. There we go. Proposition A in 1992 actually created the Seismic Safety Loan Program, set aside $150 million at that time for an affordable housing loan program with funds from the underlying loans to be loaned at one-third of the city's true interest cost. And a market rate loan program that set aside $200 million to be loaned at 1% above the city's true interest cost. The The Seismic Safety Loan Program was implemented by the Administrative Code Chapter 66 and 66A at the time. They described the conditions for participation in the Seismic Safety Loan Program, including lending criteria, application and approval process, closing and servicing procedures, and the like. Fast forward to 2016, the voters voted to enact Proposition C, which allows Seismic Safety Loan Program funds to be used to, quote, finance the costs to acquire, improve, and rehabilitate, and to convert at-risk multi-unit residential buildings to permanent affordable housing. And as of this year, there are approximately $105 million in the Affordable Housing Loan Program left, and $150 million in the Market Rate Loan Program left to spend for these purposes. In terms of potential uses for the Proposition C funding, MoCD has identified four. The first is a direct financing model where we would underwrite long-term acquisition or rehabilitation financing for projects and then disperse the funds directly to buyers of buildings. There's a takeout financing model that we're also looking at, which would wherein MoCD would work with a bridge lender to provide short-term financing that MoCD would later take out with bond proceeds. A pooling and securitization model, which following an initial execution using either the direct or takeout financing models, we would pool the outstanding loans and issue securities, the proceeds of which would be used to pay off the underlying loans. And then finally, a whole loan purchase model, very similar to the pooling and securitization model, except that it would be whole loans purchased versus securitization. In terms of MoCD's progress toward issuance and lending under the program, we have assembled a transaction team and begun meetings. We've completed an RFP process and selected bond counsel. It's Jones Hall here in the city. We've conducted meetings including MoCD, bond counsel, the Controller's Office of Public Finance, and the City Attorney's Office on the issues already. We've resolved many outstanding issues and structured a program. Some of the legal and administrative issues we've worked on include the permitted uses of Prop C funds and general obligation bond proceeds, timing of issuances, and city contracting requirements that would be applicable to various types of loans that we'd be lending. And we've also developed a general program structure that would meet affordable housing financing needs while complying with the legal and administrative requirements of the program. We've also drafted revisions to Chapter 66A, which, as I mentioned before, is the implementing legislation for the 1992 proposition, and then, of course, also applicable to the 2016 proposition. We've worked with the City Attorney's Office to draft these proposed revisions such that they'll allow MoCD to implement Prop C given market conditions and project finances. In terms of next steps, MoCD will finalize and secure approval of the Chapter 66 to 66A legislation. We'll create a pipeline of MoCD projects to be financed with the first bond issuance, draft general lending guidelines and template loan documents to be included in the Board of Supervisors packet with the first issuance. We'll finalize and secure approval of the bond issuance legislation, and then finally fund loans through one of the four methods I discussed earlier. In terms of a proposed timeline, February 8, 2018 is when we expect the Chapter 66 and 66A revisions to be adopted, and we hope to issue our first general obligation bond under the program May 2018 and fund the first loans in July of 2018. With that, I will conclude my comments and answer any questions you may have.
Yeah, I had back to the first slide.
Sure.
I just want to make sure I understand. So from the 1992 authorization, Proposition A, is that where there was 150 and 200? Is that where the 105 and the 150 are coming from that? So under Prop C of 2016, there's no new money. It's just revisiting the leftover money from that 1992.
That's correct. So between 1992 and 2016, there was these were not particularly popular programs, it seems, because there, you know, there's 105 million left in the affordable program, and 150 of 200 million left in the market rate loan program. So those are all funds that were authorized back in 92 and then still remain in the programs.
Okay, so maybe then in the future you will produce a quarterly report with more detail about the budgets and the projects and status, similar to the bond report that we get now for the 2015 affordable housing?
That's certainly something we could do.
I think generally we require a quarterly report on the bonds.
So. Well, then we'll certainly do it.
Okay, appreciate that. And you can look to that to maybe see a format that's... and then on the next page, the potential uses of Prop C funding, you had four different models. And I don't want to get too deep into it, but is there a reason why you pick four and not just one? And what is the most efficient, or why there's four different models?
Sure. So I think there, depending on the type of project and the type of loan that that we'd like to fund, different models work better. You know, for example, the takeout financing model would work for loans that have to be issued very quickly. A bridge lender could come in, underwrite the loans much quicker than a city process, and the city could come in and take out the bridge lender. For loans that are have a longer time horizon, the city could do the direct lending itself. And really, we're not we haven't settled on using all four of these models. But what we've tried to do is structure a program that would be flexible enough to allow all four models. So it may be the case that we spend these funds exclusively using the takeout model or something of that nature. But
what's an example of a bridge lender? Is that a nonprofit or a private organization, and do they get fees and take a part of the proceeds?
I can't speak for what MoCity would, what leadership at MoCity would do in that case, but I would imagine it would be a nonprofit lender. I have a few in mind, and they would take a spread, but would move much more quickly than the city possibly could.
Kate Hartley, I just wanted to add to Adam's response. The Seismic Safety Loan Program is different than the general obligation bond because it's broken into $35 million tranches. We can only draw down $35 million a year. But once we do, we have to start paying debt service on those. And so that's different. We will start incurring costs. And so we don't want to incur those interest costs before we have projects lined up to pay the interest. And because our acquisition rehab programs tend to be on the smaller side in terms of what each project itself costs, it might be, you know, a building, a 6 or 7 unit building where they need $3 or $4 million of loan proceeds. And so the idea is, in order to make it as cost effective as possible, is to use a bridge lender, which is typically what MoCity does, is use a community development financing agency.
What's an example of one of those, the name of one?
Like Enterprise Community Partners. They make bridge loans. Local Initiative Support Corporation. They make bridge loans, but also private entities do too. So we would go for obviously the best rate, the best terms, aggregate those projects, and then as soon as we have our $35 million worth of projects ready to go, we could issue the bonds, and the city would not have to incur interest in excess of the cost.
So is the bridge lenders, are they picked through a competitive process to get, or do you negotiate?
We ask the borrowers to survey the market and bring the best terms to us. It's not just interest rate; it's the fees and the term of the loan. But it's possible that That's not the best way. I mean, we may have larger projects come forward where we could do an issuance ourselves and forego the expenses of the bridge lender. So that's why Adam outlined our alternatives, because standing here today, we don't know exactly what the projects will be and what their costs will be. We know what the overall goal is, and that is to preserve at-risk housing and to stop vacancy decontrol and to stabilize households in their rent-controlled apartments. But we want to be able to be flexible so that we can react quickly and put those funds to good use with minimal expenses.
Okay, thank you. Just I think I have one more question, and that's on the permitted uses of Prop C funds. Is there a legal opinion now regarding the use of general obligation bonds to make loans? Because generally, you know, they're used for capital construction projects. And I think we've talked about this before, but I was just wondering if there's a legal opinion, and city attorney's office or public finance may have the answer to that.
Ken Ruth, who the deputy city attorney through the chair. Could you repeat your question?
Is there a legal opinion that use of general obligation bonds for making loans is legal?
Yes, this was when we drafted this ordinance, MOHCD had this in mind. So we had extensive conversations both internally and with our outside bar about what legal processes and procedures we would need to have in order to be sure that this was met all applicable legal standards, specifically the Constitution, the state Constitution standards. And the answer is yes.
So did the city attorney's office issue a legal opinion?
No, there was not a formal legal opinion we issued. However, I should note that whenever bonds, whether they're GO bonds or any other bonds, are issued by the city, both our office and outside counsel has to issue an opinion, a formal opinion that says that the bonds are, in effect, legal. We can't go to the market without those opinions. That's what investors demand. Correct. So there's no formal legal opinion on that specific point, but there is that point is necessarily inferred by the opinions that our office and outside counsel produces.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I have one last question. These loans will be repaid, or they're not going to end up like being, is there an expectation there will be a repayment and then a fund, an ongoing kind of fund would be established for the future? Or?
This will be hard debt, so it will be repaid over time.
And how does that accounted for, and where are the funds going?
Well, so depending on the model, you know, for example, the funds under the pooling and securitization model would after a takeout would come back into the program to be lent out for the same purposes, but in terms of the, you know, the accounting for interest payments on outstanding loans, I think maybe Benjamin would be better positioned to answer that question.
Sure.
Our office makes loans all the time for housing projects, and we rely on the excellent fund accounting system that the controller's office has established. The very basics of our how we account for every transaction puts every single transaction in a specific bucket that defines allowable uses of those funds. And when we receive a repayment, we associate that repayment with what the original source of funds was, and we create revolving loan pools with those same restrictions as the original source of funds.
So is there a way to monitor when payments become late and or loans need to be written off for lack? There's data on that.
Yes. We have an entire asset management team in our office that's even separate from our fiscal team, and our asset management team pays attention to all of our outstanding.
So when I remember as a voter understanding this and loving the creativity in all of these sort of loan programs, but I think what we are struggling with is this is not the type of geobond project that we usually govern, right?
So. True.
This is a whole different world for us.
Yes.
But yet we are still responsible for the governance of it. And that, I don't know about my colleagues, but that particular area about how this money gets back in, I'd like to understand better. And particularly because you've been doing it for years, you can tell us what the rates of return are and how that affects. Because I, again, as a voter, I felt like, wow, this is great. This program's just going to pay for itself years and years. And I had radical assumptions that this is going to change our city for the next 50 years, right? My guess is that with loan repayment rates and things like that, that actually is not, that there's a reality there that in if I financial reality that is very different than my assumptions. And so I don't know if my colleagues feel especially strongly about understanding this aspect, which I think affects both of the issues, right?
Well,
both the seismic one and the non-seismic one.
There's the two different bonds that we've been talking about this morning are structured differently. The one that Adam's been talking about, the repurposing of the seismic safety loan, that require, as he described it, it's hard debt. It has required repayments of principal and interest on a schedule. The what we were talking about before, the general obligation bonds for general affordable housing, those loans don't necessarily have, they're not necessarily hard debt. So for example, with that funding source, a loan might be made to a nonprofit housing developer to build a building, and our repayment functions on residual receipts or ground lease payments if the city owns the land. And the loan functions not only to receive some repayment on the loan, but also as a means of securing for the city that this building is going to be served for low-income people.
Yeah, what I'm suggesting is we actually put this on the agenda for a future meeting, because I think that nuance right there, mm-hmm. and that assumption that all of that, I think that we need to spend a little bit of time talking about, because and what mechanisms are in place to ensure that those that we're investing in the right properties that are going to do that. You know, so that's why it comes back to our questions earlier about, like, you're moving from here to here, but you know, you're making all these other assumptions are built on top of that. And so I think we have to get into this stuff at that level to feel more, I would feel more comfortable about the governance of this. So I think that, maybe we can talk about that for a future meeting.
We can absolutely describe the two different models and also what we've experienced historically under those two different models to just give you a sense of what repayment looks like.
Great. And the assumptions we're making. I think that would make me feel much more comfortable with this, with closing this.
One thing to call to your attention, thank you for asking for this forward calendar of bond issuances. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a useful thing to have in your packets. But the amount that's proposed in the May issuance is small, $15 million, you can see. And the reason for that is, as they were describing, they don't want to have cash on hand that's not ready to spend. And so the pattern will look a little different than a lot of bond programs.
Yeah, it probably will come up faster, too, was my assumption. So one question about the your office. You said that when you were analyzing this, you came up with some what would be the right way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
That would make it legal. So are there processes that are governing what makes this legal, and are they, how do we ensure that they're being followed?
Well, I should say, first of all, I'm not involved in this first issuance. One of my colleagues is, so I'm not hands-on on that particular sort of day-to-day work. But traditionally, what happens in a transaction like this is, When we draft the ordinance, if there are kind of new and unusual issues, as this one presented, we again collaborate with our outside bar, find out how we can do this and how we can't. And then we work with outside counsel for the first issuance to make sure those are in place. As far as I'm aware, we don't have any sort of written procedures. I can report back to you on what we're doing for this tranche, if that's helpful
okay.
to you.
Yeah. I mean, my concern, again, is the nature of a bunch of people are making, you know, individual decisions based on applications that it seems really different than some of our big loans. And so if there's any, my guess is that we couldn't get approval to use the bonds funds for this type of thing without saying we are going to, for every applicant, we're going to, you know, look at what they're saying equally. Or, I mean, I'm sure, I would hope that there's a lot of structure around that. So if maybe we can get at that, you know, in a future one where we can understand all of this.
Sure. I would just note that sort of from a bond counsel and from our office's perspective, those questions are not necessarily the questions we'll be looking at.
Okay. So. Okay. Well, thank you for letting me know. Sorry to delay this, please.
If I might, so I recall both bond measures or both ballot measures. So 1989, we have an earthquake. 1992, we have a Proposition A that establishes this mechanism for loans for seismic work. And by, I guess, 2016, it is carried on the books. It is not utilized, carried on the books. In 2016, Proposition C is on the ballot, passes by the voters, that says, let's use this money that has up until this point not been utilized or used for its intended purposes. We'll reassign a use, and the use is to finance the cost to acquire, approve, and rehabilitate and to convert at-risk multi-unit residential buildings. So at some point, there's got to be some criteria that establishes the definition of an at-risk multi-unit residential building that is eligible to be converted. If there is, I don't know what it is, and I'm sure someday we might. And then in addition, so we've got existing language in the admin code in chapter 66 and 66A, in which we say it speaks directly to these dollars that were allocated either under the 92 Prop A do not speak to this change in use that was authorized under the 2016 Prop C measure, and that revisions to admin code sections chapter 66, 66A will be going to the board at some point. And what I would like to know is when that does occur, will those proposed revisions to the Board of Supes for Chapter 66 and 66A come back to us for advisory review? Because I think what we're hearing is there's some detail here in which this committee, has oversight, and there's some detail as it relates to whether it fits inside one-time expenditure type bonds or it doesn't. Or so two things. One, do we have a definition of it? We don't need it today, of at risk, and will we see the proposed revisions to admin code 66 and 66A before it goes to the board?
Yes, Mr. Hughes. So as you surmised, you know, that definition will be contained in the revisions to Chapter 66A, as well as in MOCD's underwriting guidelines, which are passed by the Citywide Affordable Housing Loan Committee. So to some extent, Chapter 66A will refer to those guidelines. But I think both could certainly be presented to this board in advance of the legislation at the Board of Supervisors.
And I would just say if when you do share that revisions to the admin code with us, you can give us the marked up copy that, you know, there's always that shows what the adds, the deletions, you know.
Certainly.
Great.
Any other comments? Thank you for your patience with us as we learn to how to the unique aspects of these bonds and what our role is. Is there any public comment? Seeing none.
Item 5, presentation from Public Works regarding the 2010 and 2014 earthquake safety and emergency response bonds and possible action by the committee in response to such presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. We're loading up our presentation. Thank you for your patience.
While we're waiting, I will let my colleagues know that the earthquake safety bond has a $142 million issuance coming up in the March-April timeframe.
Commissioners, good morning. My name is Charles Aguirre. I am the bond program manager, Earthquake Safety Emergency Response 2010 and 2014. I'm going to lead off here, but I'm going to ask each of the particular project managers responsible for the particular components to present briefly their particular component. I will speak on behalf of one of the managers who is not here today. So this is our quarterly report as of September 2017 and with financials through June of 2017. Speaking to both the matter of ESER 2010 and ESER 2014, and would like to highlight for you some of the accomplishments we've achieved in recent time. 26 of our planned 30 cisterns for the AWSS, Auxiliary Water Supply System, have been completed. Fire stations 5, 16, and 35 are underway. Specifically, fire station 5 and 16 are under construction. Fire station 35 is just emerging, and I don't want to steal the thunder of the manager, so I won't go too much into detail on that front. The Traffic Company and Forensic Services Division project, which is in the ESER 2014 bond, is also emerging as we speak. Again, not to steal the thunder, you'll hear more about that shortly. Upcoming milestones, actually, you know, since this is through September, most of these have already been rendered, so to speak, or achieved. So, again, that'll be spoken to by the particular managers. In regard to bond sales and appropriation, we've issued a total of six for ESER 2010 for the entire sum obliged to that bond, if you will. And that's inclusive of interest and earnings. It's $416 million. The city has issued two bond sales for ESER 2014, totaling approximately $210 million, of which the lion's share, or the entirety, I should say, has been appropriated. Finally, on the matter of risk concerns on budget and scope or schedule, I think we're not too very different than probably most projects, public works projects that are occurring in the city now, which is that we're in a very dynamic market environment that's not especially kind to project sponsors, whether public or private, for that matter. It reflects, in regard to increased costs, certainly. That's the biggest sort of hit, if you will. Scarcity of labor. A lot of people are busy working, and that's great, great news, but there aren't as many of them as we would like to see. And, in fact, it's interesting, the conversation in recent time has been what is to be the consequence of the North Bay fires, and how is that going to create further pressure within the market in terms of the availability of workers, materials, and such. So we're in that mode of having to anticipate impact and to scope our projects, even subsequent to having to sort of establish them against the prospective budget, having to sort of be more creative in how we do that. And we can talk a little bit more about that at your pleasure. The first project up is actually a project that's been complete for about 2 years now, completed in April of 2015, and that's the public safety building, which, if you'll recall, is the new police headquarters, the relocation of Southern District Station from the hall, and as well a new fire station number 4 serving the Mission Bay area. We're coming up on completing our warranty period. That's really been the activity that has transpired since inauguration in April of 2015, has been looking after the warranty items that emerge during the period of occupancy. We're also involved with the financial closeout of the project. So pretty much one and done, so to speak, and being very successfully occupied, if I might say, based on our continuing conversations with the police department through our projects that are underway currently with them. Next project is neighborhood fire stations, fire stations 5 and 16, within the context of neighborhood fire station component, ESER 2010. I'm going to invite Magdalena Ryer to join me here. Magdalena is the new project manager in regard to this particular aspect of neighborhood fire stations. You'll see her again shortly on another matter. Magdalena actually has completed the medical examiner facility project, which she'll share with you in just a moment. So, Magdalena, if you would like to offer some remarks here.
Good morning, commissioners. Today is my officially first day as a project manager, so I'll be brief. Fire station number five, is proceeding according to the schedule. We have a topping out ceremony scheduled in January, so all good news regarding that station. Fire station 16, we experienced a delay. We are now going back and forth between the schedulers and trying to determine the substantial completion and date and final completion date. I don't want to commit or tell you any dates, but it will be sometime in summer of 2018. But the details will come after our scheduler reviews the latest schedule submitted by Roback Construction. Would you like to add anything, Charles? Fire station, and then bond 2014 fire station 35, just like Charles mentioned, we are in schematic design and also gathering information for CEQA, and all good there.
Great. I think I'd like to thank you, Magdalene. I'd like to take this opportunity to have Cherry Katz come up. She's the project manager for the Focus Scope program within NFS, and that's a considerable program, and she'll describe that to you here.
Good morning. As Charles said, my name is Sherry Katz, and I'm the project manager for all of the Focus Scope projects within ESER NFS. The projects comprise about 25% of the $81.22 million in the ESER NFS 2014, and there are there are dozens of projects, and they impact 35 fire stations. So recent milestones include the final completion of the roof HVAC and generator project at Fire Station 13, as well as a notice of award to DW Nicholson for replacement of apparatus bay doors at 10 fire stations. In addition, the upcoming milestones, or the highlights, I should say, are there are three bid advertisements that are coming up in the next 6 to 8 weeks. Two of them are envelope projects, one for Fire Station 22, one for Fire Station 24 and 34, as well as a showers package for three fire stations. And we will also be completing the roofing projects at six fire stations.
So just to comment on the work for fire stations, as you can tell, for facilities that are being replaced in whole, we're bringing them forward to modern standard, if you will, for their durability, their reliability as places from which to deploy apparatus and personnel. Where we have not the funds, certainly, to do that for all projects, we focus then on those elements of work that speak to the durability, again, of the facility. Because if a facility is compromised, especially firehouses where firefighters live and work, then it impairs their readiness to respond when called upon. And so there are elements or aspects that go to simply the integrity of the structure and how that work environment is appropriate for folks who live there 24/7. And then separately, elements or aspects that are entirely about the ability to respond immediately. Our app bay doors, apparatus, which are the engines and trucks, those doors are critical that they operate reliably each and every time. And one of the projects, and we didn't go into detail on this, but I think it bears mentioning, is that the department's interest in replacing the historic or conventional door, which would have a tendency to jam if the building frame ever racked a little bit, doesn't take much for those doors to seize up and not operate. We are replacing as many of those doors with folding doors, which are eminently more operable. Even if the building frame racks, those doors can still be open, whether mechanically or manually. And so that's huge, because if you can't get the apparatus out of the firehouse, game, set, match, there's not much you can do to respond. So those are very critical improvements that we're making. I'd like to now move on to the emergency firefighting water system. Now, as a reminder, this is a bond component that is under the direct management of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. So unfortunately, the project manager is not present here this morning to speak to these two aspects of, or I should say to these bond measures for the emergency firefighting water system. I should tell you that that is the new moniker of the auxiliary water supply system. And it's done in part because the AWSS is a historic system. It's served the city well for over 100 years, I guess, at this point. But the PUC, through their engineering oversight, their experience, their facility, so to speak, with pushing water through pipes, determined that there was kind of a different approach that they would assume for and deliver upon for this system, which is a more modern, I would call it, interpretation. Having said that much, ESER 2010 is substantially complete, and I'll be speaking to that a little bit later in the financial summary. 26, not 20, it says 28 in your PowerPoint. It's actually 26 of the 30 planned cisterns are now functional. And that's an enormously important asset that heretofore was not present in the locations where they're installed, and provide the fire department with another sort of arrow in their quiver in order to suppress fires in or around or near these cisterns. Pumping Station 2, for those of you who are familiar with it, it's an aquatic park right up against the bay. It's one of two pump stations. That pump station contract has been awarded. Took a little bit of time for that to find its way to award, but it has finally been awarded. And then finally, there are some motorization of street valves within the context of their pipe network that are expected to occur early next year with the funds drawn from ESER 2010. ESER 2014 for the EFWS continues to do a good deal of pipeline-related projects. And that really is kind of the underpinning for the most part currently, is installing more robust pipe extensions as well as strengthening existing pipelines so that they can better respond to the forces, if you will, of an earthquake. I'll leave it at that. On that front, certainly open to your questions to follow. Police facilities, I guess it's me again. Lisa Zoe is our project manager, and she's taking a well-deserved break with her family this particular holiday week. Police facility is the smallest, if you will, of the bond components in dollar value. No less important for its significance to the police department, certainly. We've been doing projects that are of the type I mentioned a second ago for NFS, which are these focus scope projects that are really about establishing the durability, the reliability of these venues for the functions that they serve. And so we have approximately 9 district stations that we're attending to in various ways. Most recently, we've issued a notice to proceed for the contractor on the Northern Richmond and Terrible stations. And we've received bids for the Park and Ingleside station already. In fact, if you were to fast forward, we already have a low bid in that regard. And we've already, I might as well just fast forward. We have obtained our approvals for our firearm simulation training facility at the pistol range at Lake Merced. And we're nearing completion of a police academy project. For those of you familiar with it, it's up at Diamond Heights in regard to their mechanical, electrical, and plumbing building upgrade system.
So that is the police facilities. I will now reintroduce Magdalena Ryer to speak on the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner project.
And briefly again, the project is completed. We received temporary certificate of occupancy on October 10th, and the building is occupied by the staff of the medical examiner's facility, and the facility is open to business as of November 6th. So we're in the closeout phase of the project. We are finalizing training and addressing punch list items.
For the next project, Traffic Company and Forensic Services Division, I'd like to introduce Michael Rossetto, the project manager.
Good morning. If you are not familiar with this project, it is taking the CSI and the Traffic Company out of the Hall of Justice and combining with the crime lab currently located out at the shipyard at Hunters Point and putting them in a new facility at 1995 Evans Avenue. Approximately a block down the street from the Public Works yard. Currently owned by the city, the Real Estate Division manages the property, and they have vacated the property as of November 10th. Notice to proceed was issued to a general contractor who will be overseeing hazardous materials abatement and demolition of the facility over the next 5 months. At the same time, recently, a notice to proceed was issued to the construction manager, general contractor, who it's Clark Construction, who will lead what we're calling a CMGC team. The team component is design, build, core trade subcontractors, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, and exterior building envelope, who will come on board starting November 27th to coincide with the executive architect team led by HOK Architects, beginning of the design development phase to work in sync with them to address budgetary concerns on the project and get the project to budget and solicit bids from those core trade subcontractors. That will start be the beginning of pre-construction services phase one. As soon as the budget is achieved and the bids are taken, we will start a pre-construction services phase two, where those core trade subcontractors will become the engineers of record and continue to work towards document preparation and permitting over the next year with HOK Architects as we move through towards construction. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Just a note on construction manager, general contractor form of delivery, CMGC. That is the favored design delivery model for most of our major capital projects. What it does effectively is introduce the builder upstream in a phase we call pre-construction, where we're able to earn their particular expertise and insights that assist the designer, the architect, and the engineering team in evolving their design in such a way that it's more consistent and aligned with best industry practices for construction. That's an invaluable a participation or partnering with the builder that we have generally found to have been very advantageous in the delivery of the work. In this particular instance, we have introduced the participation of what Michael regarded as the core trade subs. For laboratory projects, the mechanical engineer, the electrical engineer, the plumbing engineer, and those trades are critical to the success. You can well imagine that lab buildings are very dense with those kinds of systems. And so having that participation early on, again, very invaluable in earning the insights that we need to have so that the construction can occur with less conflict and compromise. Okay, so now a brief status of budget and financial plan. I am missing my senior budget analyst as well this week. It's a good week for folks taking an extended time. But that's it. Easter 2010, as you can see from the far right column, has been substantially spent.
We're at 90% between encumbrances and expenditures against either the revised budget or the appropriation. The outlier projects, if I can call them that, are the two that were described to you, Fire Stations 5 and 16 within the context of the NFS, and then some of that work that I also described to you for AWSS. Again, substantially spent down. We would expect this work to all be completed by next year.
Great. Thank you.
One more.
Yep.
Last but not least, the status of our budget and financial plan for ESER 2014. Obviously, this is underway. We're two-plus years removed from the first infusion, if you will, of bond sale funds. Medical examiner is done, effectively. I should say parenthetically that you might ask, well, why is that done? And everything else seems to be a few percentage points behind. Well, the city, at the time it was entertaining this project for the bond, decided that it was of such importance, especially regarding its reaccreditation, that it should have funding prior to the bond to bring it to a certain level of completeness, such that when the bond passed, we could pick it up and, after a very short duration of further development, go to construction. And so that was a very wise approach for getting it done sooner. Clearly, it's evidenced by what we've described to you and this percentage. The other projects, as you can see, for the most part, are still in their preliminary phases, although I would tell you that police facilities among the bond components is really fast and otherwise out of the gate and completing some work very quickly. In sum total, I could tell you that the ambition we have, the plan, is to complete ESER 2014 by the fall, late fall of 2019. We are preparing, as we speak, for ESER 2020. And so we want to make certain that as we present ourselves to the voters in that year, which is the latter part, I believe it'll be November of 2020, that we could speak to all of the good work that we've accomplished and also to the fact that we will have spent the monies that have been entrusted to us to that point. We don't want to have a sum of money sitting there and having people wondering, why are you asking us for more money when you still are sitting on a bunch? So that is our plan across all of the bond components, inclusive of the EFWS as well. So with that, we will conclude the presentation and ask for any questions you may have.
Okay, please.
My question is about the ESER and the old auxiliary water supply system. I live in the Outer Richmond District, and the Richmond District Review's November issue, a local paper that covers the Richmond District, has an article about a system that is planned now to replace the AWSS. And among the things that it says is that the new system is going to rely on the domestic water system to provide firefighting and questions its integrity as to whether or not it will stand up during an earthquake, especially an earthquake of some magnitude like, you know, the 1906 earthquake. Apparently one of the reasons PUC doesn't want to do this, a legitimate reason, is that they have an estimate of $3.7 million a mile for domestic water piping as opposed to $19 million a mile for the strengthened piping with you know, the joints that have the mechanical connections on them and some upgraded fire hydrants, I guess. A big money difference, according to the estimate that they quoted in the paper. Hard for me to imagine a difference of five times. I mean, if you had me doing it, sure, $19 million a mile, but if you had a good crew doing it, I would question that a little bit. But that aside, what is the PUC's position on that? Is it just a matter of cost, or are they confident that in the event of a large earthquake, the firefighting system will be capable of delivering the water that we're going to need to fight the fires?
That's an excellent question. If I'll do it justice, I'm not an engineer. I'm an architect, can't represent the PUC as well as they could, certainly. But what I can tell you is that The PC has been studying the modernization, if I could call it, and the expansion of the emergency firefighting water system for a number of years now. There is, as the goal, a parity throughout the city in the access to dedicated firefighting water. That said, there are different ways to accomplish it. Clearly, the system that was designed subsequent to the 1906 earthquake was landmark. In fact, so landmark, it's really never been attempted again in the modern age. I think there are two, I wouldn't say comparable, but two that resemble it in a very remote way, and that's one in Japan, one in Vancouver. It is, by the PUC, and I think generally the opinion that it is a prohibitively expensive approach to providing for dedicated high-pressure firefighting water. What the PUC has done is to, with its specialty engineering consultant, pursue a tack that would more quickly provide for that parity in access to firefighting water sooner than not. If we were to spend the multiple, Commissioner, that you remarked upon, given the pacing of the bond program, at least historically, it would take us far longer to accomplish that parity than if we pursue a less expensive tack. As far as its reliability and durability, I would really prefer to have the PUC speak to that. Yeah. I do know, though, that it would be more in the new iteration, if you will, of a co-benefits potable water system, that it would be more durable than what currently exists in the regular hydrant system. So all told, as I said, PUC has been looking at it very critically. They're trying to approach it in a way that, as I said, renders that access to good firefighting dedicated water much sooner than not. We know that the big one, as we call it, it's not a question of when, it's a, if rather, it's a question of when. And the U.S. Geological Service is, we're getting closer to that end date where the USGS has said we're probably going to experience it. And so any delays in not doing as much as we can for as many in the city is probably not the most prudent approach. So I'll stop there. Hopefully I lightly at least brushed up against
the answer. You know, you're at a disadvantage. You don't have the project manager for this here to answer a question as specific as this, but maybe you could give me his contact information because I would
absolutely.
I would like to follow
we'll
up.
We'll follow up with you. Yes, in fact, I do believe that the PUC will be responding to the article that was published in at least two of the neighborhood newspapers.
Yeah, I think the Sunset Beacon had it too. Well, they're the same paper almost.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as I said, I'll defer further discussion until we can.
No, we'll certainly get back to you with a little bit more detail of the sort that you're seeking.
I'd appreciate that.
Yes.
I had a couple of quick questions. The Fire Station 35, it's noted that there was a notice to proceed for October 10th. Did that happen?
Yes.
That's been issued?
Yes.
Okay. And then the other question I had was the hazmat and demo for the traffic company and forensic services mm-hmm. was going to be a notice to proceed in October. Did that happen? So that happened. Okay, great. No, that's so fine. That's
Michael Rosetto.
The notice to proceed was issued October 20th.
Yeah.
There were some delays with the real estate division in vacating the property, and that happened on November 10th. But everything is proceeding.
Great. And so in my role as the liaison for these two bond issues, I, in this last quarter, did have a tour of the new Chief Medical Examiner building along with Brenda. And so I want to thank Charles and project manager Magdalena for that tour. It's, I thought, a very, very impressive building. It's going to serve, I think, the citizens of this of San Francisco for many, many years to come. It's really state of the art, and I really appreciate the opportunity to get to see that. The second thing I did also this last quarter was, it was mentioned here that the AWSS pumping station number 2, which is at the very foot of Van Ness Avenue where the Muni Pier begins to take off, that's been awarded. The contract was awarded for about $18 million. It's going to be a $26 million seismic upgrade of that facility. And a lot of steel will be going into it, but there's also some historic preservation. But it was really great to get a tour of that and see it before they've actually started the construction, and then we'll be able to come back periodically and take a look and see how that's going. So I really wanted to appreciate David Meyerson.
David Meyerson.
The project manager from the PUC on that. So I'm really looking forward to that. I did review the bid items. There were a couple of bid items where the bid that came in that was awarded, the contractor was very much lower than what our engineers' estimates were. And that always concerns me because that's the potential for change orders. So I did talk to David about, you know, trying to watch that very carefully and holding the contractor's feet to the fire on those low bid items.
No pun intended. I thank you for that, Commissioner. You know, one of the things I would like to say, and you know, in fairness to the PUC, you know, there's been some amazing work completed for the AWSS system, certainly within the context of the ESCR bond. As I mentioned, 26 of 30 cisterns, large 75 to 100,000 gallon cisterns. We seismically restored the Ashbury tank as well as the Jones Street tank. We repaired and strengthened the Twin Peaks Reservoir. These are all, and pump station, the Ashbury, well, the tank there, but the pump stations are being undertaken now. These are all critical components of the overall system. We can certainly have discussions about the pipe network. That's very important, but I don't think it can be lost in the conversation that we've done some awfully robust strengthening and improvement of this system that was much needed, much needed. So I would like that to be understood, as well as the current discourse about what the best pipe line approach should be.
Okay. Now, so in addition, when I did get the detailed quarterly report for the ESCR bond programs for September, I noticed, and it was noticed in the report, that the financial data was as of June, so there was no updated financial information to review. Could you comment on why the September financial data wasn't available, and is it now available, or what's going on there? Because I've heard references to the new city system. I'd like to just know when I might be able to see September financial data.
Commissioner, the new financial system adopted by the city currently does not enable us to collect the data that we require in order to present you the reliable and accurate.
Even as of today?
That's correct. Currently, I'm sure that will improve.
So this is Peg Stevenson. There were a lot of cost centers in the new financial system where the budget data didn't come over accurately, and we've got accountants working on making all the corrections. I honestly can't tell you what the schedule is for the different types of expenditures. They're making a lot of progress, and I'll find out with Ben, and I'll check with our fund accounting supervisors and update you. I need to know myself. I mean, I assume that it wouldn't run past the end of another quarter, but I can't say that from personal experience. So I will find out and know what priority order the bond programs are going to be in, and so we can be accurate about it before you would be receiving any more quarterly reports.
All right. And then last, I mean, it is important for the liaisons to have meetings with the bond staff, and my attempts to get a meeting scheduled this time were not successful. And so maybe, Charles, you could comment on that. I mean, I think I've sent some emails and made some phone calls, but didn't get replies. And again, not having the financial data is, but there were still other things I think I've been asking for, such as, you know, any projects that have fallen off from the schedule or, you know, changes in the schedule, but didn't get that either. So could we I think we have to figure out a better way to communicate this setup.
Yes. Well, apologies again for failing to align with your schedule and ours. I think that's the first time we've missed the opportunity to sit with you and review matters at a finer grain of detail. So we'll definitely endeavor to do much better the next time out. Certainly, we're available to you if you would like to delve into any of what you were interested in prior to this particular meeting. We obviously stand at the ready to respond to you.
Great. I appreciate that very much. That's all for me.
Okay. And one more general follow-up question not related to the PSIP or the firefighting program. In discussing the CMGC method of project delivery, you referred to core trade subs. Now, they do bid competitively on their scope of work. Is that not right?
Within the delivery of this particular project, they will be functioning what we call a design assist role. They're now part of the official CMGC team. We will be working with our architect team as well as with the builder team to arrive at a price point, if you will, for the respective work of those core trade subs. We will then have a moment in time where we'll say, now you have to put your name to that number. And there will be a number that we will have reconciled and understood to be appropriate for the scope of work, especially within the context of all the other work that needs to occur. Hopefully it's a more or less fait accompli at that point when we decide. We already have, parenthetically, an understanding of what we believe those numbers should be. Now it's a matter of agreeing to agree. They will be given that opportunity to basically affirm the number. If by some curious set of circumstances they choose not to, then we would be duty bound to go out to others to secure a pricing more in line with our budget capacity for those particular elements of work.
Okay. This sounds more like negotiated procurement than a competitively bid.
Well, it's different from putting out a set of documents and asking for it to be bid. In this market especially, I would opine that this is a more certain way to arrive at a favorable disposition of the scope and its corresponding cost. We are being buffeted by the market when we put out documents that we believe should be X and the cost comes in at 2X. Mm. And there was no opportunity for a discussion regarding, well, why 2X? Uh-huh. It just is. And curiously, when some projects have de-scoped because of that overage and gone back out, it comes in yet again higher. Yeah. So there is not a lot of rhyme or reason. It's that dynamic of marketplace. And so we firmly believe that this is a more certain way to avoid that head-scratching moment where we have to lower scope and or quality and then suffer another cost bump.
No, I don't question that you made the decision in good faith. It's just, to me, it's atypical. You know, even with CMGC, usually I thought you did.
True. This is, as I mentioned, that's correct, Commissioner. As I mentioned earlier, it's a bit of a twist because of the unique characteristics of a lab-centric facility and why we thought this was a more spot-on approach to getting. Our ultimate number is our ultimate number, right? We have to work within it, and so we do believe that this is a way to stay within that number.
And I'm sympathetic to what you say about labs. You know, you're going to get loads and loads of change orders regardless of how much effort you put into the design process. So, you know, good luck to you.
Thank you.
You're doing this in accordance with the California Public Contracting Code, though.
Yes.
Okay.
In our own city administrative code, which, as a charter city, gives us the latitude to do different.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So to follow up on what Robert said, it sounded like we don't have updated financials, and you have got some
some outstanding requests for those. I noticed that they're, yet again, Peg, I love our sheet here, that you guys are going out for your last bond of $142 million, which I see is across both bonds, probably 2010 and 2014. Yeah. Is that right?
I think that's just 14.
It doesn't look like 14 has that much left. They only have 94 left. Unless I'm reading this wrong.
Whatever. Right. Well, so there's a bond sign coming up immediately, but this is the one subsequent to the immediate bond.
When's the immediate one, and how much is that?
I believe it's the parks and road improvement.
Oh, no, I'm just talking about this.
Or our specifically.
Yeah, this specifically,
Is in this, in the, I guess, the late spring, early summer of
November. Right. So what I hear is that we have some concerns. Yeah.
So in the second page of the report, the 2014 is issued $210,251,000. Mm-hmm. So this 140, and they have capacity to go to, what, $400 million. So this brings them up to about $350 million. So okay. There still would be, is there a reason why you didn't do the last $50 million?
The last $50 million under the
2014 bond authorization.
Well, we, we're informed or dictated by our prospective cash flow. We're not allowed to sit on bond sale funds.
I understand.
Very long, and so we try to really be very respectful and mindful of, I think it's a 3-year spend down of bond sum. So if our cash flow suggests we're going beyond that 3 years, then we don't pursue that sum of money, right. Whatever the balance is.
My suggestion is, so our liaisons are really important to our process because we can't know everything, right, each of us. And these are really complex bonds. And so my suggestion is to our chair that in our January 22 meeting, we just have an agenda item where we quickly revisit this to make sure that Robert has gotten the updated financials and everything that he feels comfortable with prior to this bond sale. Because from our governance perspective, the only thing that we can do is stop the bond sale.
Sure.
And so we need to feel, we need to make sure that Robert and this body feels comfortable moving forward. And I don't know whether the procurement issues also are really relevant here. But that would be great to try and do between now and the 22nd of January.
Certainly.
My other comments were, you said at one point that it was a wise approach to plan these things ahead of time. And we believe...
I'm sorry, to what?
You were talking about the... one of your... Chief Medical Examiner building, and you said we had planned that ahead of time, and so we were able to move much faster. Mm-hmm. That is a wise approach. We agree, and we're working with hopefully a lot of other bonds to take that approach. The only other thing that I wanted to say is it can be really hard to read these things with a lot of acronyms in them, and so if you can sort of spell things out a little bit, it would be really helpful.
Certainly. We'll improve on that the next time.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Any public comment? Seeing none.
Item 6.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Presentation from the whistleblower program and possible action by the committee in response to such presentation.
Did you want me to read your thing first? I might as well, because we're waiting. While we're waiting, our liaison is also our chair. Oh, you want to present first? Okay, sorry. She has a liaison report that I'm going to read for her, but probably not as well as she would do it herself.
Good morning. My name is Tanya Ledeju. I'm the chief audit executive for the city services auditor on the audit side. And with me today, I have principal investigator Steve Flaherty, who is responsible for the whistleblower program. So today's presentation is an update on whistleblower program activities and initiatives through quarter one of fiscal year 2017-18. We last presented before you on May 2017, at which time we reviewed fiscal year 2016-17 activities through quarter three. And since our last presentation, we issued our quarter four annual report and two fraud bulletins, which are on our website. And we anticipate issuing our fiscal year 17-18 quarter one report in December. And in advance of today's presentation, whistleblower program staff supported quarterly meetings with our liaison, Brenda Kiwi McNulty, our chair, who will keep the CGOBOC apprised of the program activities. So for the benefit of new CGOBOC members, our first four slides will provide an overview of the whistleblower program, authority, jurisdiction, and role in ensuring a well-run city government. And the whistleblower program's authority is derived from three sources, as stated on our slide. California Government Code 53087.6 empowers the city and a county auditor controller to maintain a whistleblower program to receive information regarding allegations of fraud, waste, or abuse by local government employees. Campaign and Governmental Conduct Code Article 4 implements Charter Appendix F and directs the controller as the city services auditor to administer a whistleblower program. And San Francisco Charter Appendix F1.07 requires the controller to administer a whistleblower program. The whistleblower program investigates and resolves four broad categories or complaints, as stated on our slide: misuse of city funds, improper activities by city officials and employees, deficiencies in the quality and delivery of government services, and wasteful and inefficient government practices. The whistleblower program is tasked with investigating these matters per San Francisco Charter Appendix F and Campaign Governmental Code Article 4. Per San Francisco Campaign and Government Code, Conduct Code, Article 4, Section 4.107, the whistleblower program shall refer the following complaints. So those which another city department is required by federal, state, or local law to adjudicate, those which may be resolved through a grievance mechanism, those involving violations of criminal law. However, the controller may take action on the non-criminal aspect of the matter. Oftentimes when we receive complaints, sometimes there are criminal elements and at the same time there are non-criminal elements. Those subject to an existing investigation by the district attorney, city attorney, or ethics commission, where the applicable official or commission states in writing that an investigation by the controller would impede or delay their own investigation into the matter, those which allege violations of governmental ethical laws. An organization's hotline reporting system serves many purposes, mainly a confidential place for employees to report concerns. It serves as a central source for complaint intake, ensures that systemic issues and risk trends are identified early and can be proactively addressed by city management.
Good morning. I'll now talk a little bit about the complaint volume trends, and it goes back approximately five fiscal years to fiscal year 2012-13. The annual number of complaints received by the whistleblower program has increased every year since fiscal year 12-13. In the last fiscal year, the whistleblower program received 415 complaints, which was a 28% increase from the previous fiscal year. This increase in complaint trend looks likely to continue into fiscal year 17-18, as we have received 121 complaints in quarter one, which is a 17% increase in the number of complaints as received from the same quarter in the previous fiscal year. We'll talk a little bit about some of the trends within the complaint volume on the next slide. Before then, though, however, the controller's office uses multiple forms of proactive communication to make employees and members of the public aware of the whistleblower program. Last fiscal year, the whistleblower program issued a on-demand outreach video, which we distributed to existing employees and requested the departments include in their new employee orientation programs. The whistleblower program also tries to use other forms of proactive communication, including the issuance of quarterly reports and fraud bulletins. The majority of the complaints we receive every year come through our online web form. This number includes complaints received via 311. The web form is an important tool, as not everyone feels comfortable speaking with a live person about their issue, or they do not have a private location to make a call to the whistleblower program. With the web form, individuals can use the individuals can type information in and take time to think about and review what they've written before submitting it to the whistleblower program. The web form is available 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. Complainants also have the option of filing a complaint by email, in person, over the telephone, by fax, or a written letter. These multiple intake channels ensure that the whistleblower program is readily accessible to potential complainants and available to them in a manner which they are comfortable. The majority of the complaints that we receive are anonymous. The whistleblower program takes anonymous reports seriously. As in the case of anonymous reporters, there may never be an opportunity to ask clarifying questions, so we've tried to structure our web form in a way that all the important details are captured when the individual files the complaint. As follow-up is sometimes necessary, the whistleblower program assigns each complaint a unique tracking number so that anonymous reporters can get in touch with their assigned investigator. So with the increase in complaints, we decided to analyze our complaint volume to see if there's any trends within there. We've gone back 3 years, dating back to fiscal year 14-15. This is when the complaint volume started to grow, and it's also when we started reporting out on the disposition of complaints as they were closed. And this analysis was conducted to determine the makeup of the increased complaint volume. So what we noticed, there was an increasing number of complaints closed because another charter jurisdiction had, another department had charter granted jurisdiction over the matter. This number has increased from 6% in fiscal year 14-15 to 10%, and that looks likely to continue in fiscal year 17-18. The other trend that we noticed is that the whistleblower program was closing more complaints due to the merging them with previously investigated issues or investigations that were in progress. This is another trend that looks likely to continue into this fiscal year. And I think what accounts for that are a couple things. One, the whistleblower program, you know, we've made great attempts to make city employees aware as to our existence. We've also freely available to employees. We can't control what comes in. They access the form or of their own accord, or they file a complaint with us of their own accord. But we take it in. We take everything in, and we process that appropriately. In the event that a complaint is under the jurisdiction of another city department, we refer that complaint over to the department and make sure they've accepted the complaints and confirmed that acceptance before closing the matter on our end. So as I mentioned, the number of complaints that we received this fiscal year is a 17% increase from the 103 complaints we received in the same period of the previous fiscal year. The whistleblower program has closed 112 complaints in quarter one. The majority of these complaints were closed within 90 days of their receipt. It's the goal of the whistleblower program to close 80% of the complaints they receive within 90 days. And going into quarter two, we had 63 complaints open, and we'll talk about the aging of those on the next slide. The whistleblower program understands that it's important for complainants to feel that their concerns are important and seriously considered, so we make every effort to complete investigations in a timely manner. If complaints are not resolved in a timely manner, we realize that complainants may conclude that their allegations are not being taken seriously. Resolving incidents consistently and timely improves employee trust. Through quarter one of the fiscal year, the whistleblower program closed 94 of their 112 complaints, or 84%, in 90 days or less. That said, though, not all complaints get closed within 90 days, and there are several factors which can influence the length of an investigation, causing it to go beyond that mark. These factors include the number of allegations in the complaint, the number of witnesses and subjects necessary to interview, need to coordinate investigative efforts among multiple departments, and the need to gather documentation or other evidence from multiple sources. The whistleblower program ended quarter one with 63 open complaints. The majority of these complaints, or 78%, were open less than 90 days at the start of quarter two. I'll now hand it back to Tanya to talk about some of the whistleblower program's initiatives in fiscal year 2017-18.
Thank you. So once an allegation is reported, as Steve has talked earlier about, it must be addressed and when necessary, fully investigated. And so oftentimes delays in completion of investigations, it will damage our reputation or the program's reputation. And so we take the time to critically assess each and every claim that comes in to determine which investigator on our team should investigate that particular complaint, as well as do we have jurisdiction over that complaint. And when we don't have jurisdiction over that complaint, as we've talked about earlier, then we triage that complaint appropriately to the correct department. So with that in mind, we have taken the time to ensure that we have strong protocols in place within our organization. And part of those protocols, not only in training our own staff and ensuring that we understand how to properly investigate as well as document, we have now designed a program to do so with our own liaisons within the department. So we have a pool of liaisons within our departments, and just here on November 14, we conducted a course. I think the class was about 3 to 4 hours, and we had over 54 individuals in attendance at that training across our 50-plus departments. And when we completed that training, we sent out all slides. The class was interactive, as well as the fact that we have sent out a survey to receive feedback on the training to ensure that the training was fully understood, to determine where there were other areas that needed additional explanation, as well as where we could improve overall in the training program. And so we plan on building out on those topics in the spring of 2018.
The other initiative that we are continuing in fiscal year 2017-18 are the issuance of fraud bulletins, or bulletins that make employees aware of red flags associated with common and costly workplace or occupational frauds. Part of this effort is to help employees understand what's appropriate for referral to the whistleblower program or filing with the whistleblower program versus another city department. In this past quarter, to fiscal year to date in 2017-18, we've published two fraud bulletins. And these fraud bulletins were on insider threats, or in other words, employees with trusted status within an organization using organizational systems or data for personal gain. And we also issued a fraud bulletin on grant misuse. And the whistleblower program intends to issue two additional fraud bulletins before the end of the fiscal year. In fiscal year 2017-18, we're also continuing our popular fraud hotline webinar series. So the whistleblower program is focused on investigative excellence by collaborating with and disseminating hotline and investigation best practices to jurisdictions throughout North America by hosting fraud hotline webinars. And we started hosting these webinars in 2013. To date, this fiscal year, we've hosted one fraud hotline webinar. It was performed by Maricopa County in Arizona, and they spoke on the importance of property and evidence management. The whistleblower program webinars are well regarded by our peer jurisdictions, and we typically have more than 60 attendees across more than 30 jurisdictions in North America. And we've recorded the webinars, and we've made them freely available online.
And so more broadly, on one of the initiatives that we have been working on is with our professional associations, such as local government auditors, as well as the Institute of Internal Auditors, which we have been speaking about how we can have peer review for our whistleblower programs, not just ours, but amongst all the whistleblower programs that are held at the local level. So I will be in a conference this coming at the latter part of this month, and that will be one of the topic of discussions on the government side of the IIA, Institute of Internal Auditors. So this is something that I have longed for, and Ben and I have talked about much, and as well as Steve. And so my hope is in this coming new fiscal year, we'll be able to move that forward a little more. Thank you.
I will read Brenda's report now. Below are my observations from the recent meeting with whistleblower program staff. Latest geographic statistics are in line with previous reports, although the volume of complaints has increased in FY16-17. This may be attributed to greater awareness of the whistleblower program among city employees through the proactive efforts such as the visual, one-pager visual, verbal bulletins posted at workstations, presentations of whistleblower details at new hire orientation programs. I am satisfied with the process of reporting complaints is accessible to city employees and in general public. The investigative process is well thought out and professionally executed until it is closed. The program staff are professional and responsive to questions from the GOBAC, from us. The program staff are proactive in increasing the scope and frequency of training the designated program liaisons in every city department. I welcome and applaud the program staff to host the first ever program training for designated liaisons of all city departments with 54 people attending. That's fantastic. With the objective of training them on the various aspects of the program towards a more efficient and collaborative effort in carrying out investigations. Thank you. It sounds great.
I had a couple of questions. It seems like, and I might be wrong, but before we would get a report showing complaints by department and over time, so you could kind of see, is that, did we decide not to do that report anymore, or am I mistaken we didn't do that in the past?
Sure, I believe the statistics you're referring to, we still make those available. They're contained in our quarterly reports and annual reports.
Oh, okay. That's probably where I saw it.
Yeah. So it lists the complaints that were investigated and closed by departments with more than 200 employees.
Yeah.
And then there's another chart in those reports as well that show which complaints were referred to which department for charter granted jurisdiction reasons.
So was there a September quarterly report that had that?
So the quarter one report for fiscal year 17-18 is in progress, and we're anticipating issuing it in early December.
Oh, okay. And then I'm just curious, there's one complaint over 360 days. Is there, can you say anything about the nature of that complaint? Yeah, off the top of your head. Yeah, other than
yeah. There's only one.
No, I.
Yeah, there's, I just can say there's certain complicating factors with certain complaints. Some common reasons we see complaints, age greater than others, may have to do with an employee's leave of absence from the workplace, and we just can't compel them to come back in. Some other factors overriding that, as you say, the number of allegations, the complexity of the allegations. Some employees, I think, in the city are granted certain timelines for responding to investigations. Yeah.
And then I guess this is, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, you know, we have a budget for whistleblower complaints. We have the local legislation. But is there any metrics that sort of determines whether the program is effective or changing behavior, or, you know, that would somehow, you can, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, maybe, you know, it's you would go back and change the legislation because it's not really meeting the intended purpose. I don't know. Is there some way that you folks measure your work in terms of its effectiveness?
I'd say there are, we constantly look to other jurisdictions and other maybe professional societies or any other body issuing reports on hotline programs or whistleblower programs to see what would be a good measure of effectiveness. you know, I've heard in the past, I think at some of these meetings, requests for specific dollar amounts associated with investigations. A lot of times, because the body of complaints we receive is so diverse, there's not always an explicit dollar amount associated with investigations. I think one thing we look at are the volume of complaints received. I think if it was just to make sure that we're still letting people know that we're out there, and I think complaint volume is an indicator of that. And so employee awareness is one measure, and I'd say another measure we look at that we also don't have a great deal of control about is the quality of complaints received. And I think that sometimes that's measured by substantiation rate or corrective action or preventive action taken as a result of a complaint coming in.
Yeah, I mean, it just, there's, I think, 25,000 city employees and 700,000 population, and we're getting about 400 at the most complaints. It just, that seems low to me, given that size of population. But
well, remember, as it relates to the employees, the hotline is set up for internal city employees. And one of the things that we do measure on is when we do receive complaints, our goal is to have those complaints resolved within 60 to 90 days. And generally, we've had those metrics out there. So we're looking at that. Again, we look at the quality. And the fact is, complaints are, the hotline is specifically set up for city employees. And, of course, we can receive complaint. We do receive complaints on quality of service. And sometimes those come through our citizen base as well. So I'm not sure that if I receive 1,000 complaints versus 400 complaints, does that mean that we're not doing our job, we're not effective, and or is it that because there are deterrents in place, we have the whistleblower program, it's very visible through the very different mechanisms as the bulletin, fraud bulletins, the different trainings that speaking to new employees, so forth and on. Also, the reports that go out on the website, as well as the auditing, sometimes that's very connected in different ways that may not be known to the public in general at large, also create ways of deterrent. And so the goal is really to have deterrent versus which drives down the volume, but at the same time, notice and understanding that it is available to you, to our staff and those citizens who might report.
Great answer. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think that as a deterrent and also as employees feel like they have a place to go, like it's more of a perception thing and it wouldn't necessarily be a numbers thing, but yeah.
And I'd like to say also from a social media perspective, we have I think one or two videos that we have out there as well. So I think we do a really good job trying to promote that the program exists, that we, the controller's office, takes it seriously, and that we are working with key government members of the city collectively to deal with challenges and issues that come forth from the through the program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. If I might, thank you very much for the presentation. I have always, in following up on Commissioner Carlson's thoughts a little bit, I have always struggled with the definition of closed. So we have this complaint volume trend analysis on page 7, and we have a column that says investigated and closed. And, you know, just being in the line of work that I'm in, I have, how do you measure what is closed when we have a program that provides a mechanism to make assertions of wrongdoing, and then you receive those assertions and do an investigation, and you know you get a complaint that city employee, you know, XYZ in truck 123 is sitting in front of their home for 3 hours from 11 o'clock in the morning until 2 in the afternoon, and then they get back in their city vehicle and they go somewhere. I don't know where, but they go somewhere. And so there's an investigation, and then that employee XYZ either has an explanation that is that supports why they would be home during that period of time. Many people are provided city vehicles to go home. Many people work 24 hours a day in various trades and occupations within the population of 30,000 city employees. There may be a legitimate reason. There may not be. And the result of your investigation has a finding of one or the other. And then somehow that falls in the closed, category. And so when we think about metrics and we could assign a dollar value, how much did the city lose from employee XYZ that was at home for 3 hours? And there's a dollar value you can assign to that. Or you can also measure, well, that was a complaint that had merit that resulted in a finding of wrongdoing that was stopped. That's another way you can measure it. And that's never reflected in the analysis of the material that I've ever seen. And I think, and I know I've asked you before, and I think it was, well, you know, we don't want to put in, first of all, they're confidential. We don't want to put in anything that would restrict participation in or reporting of information. But I've never understood, so closed does not speak to the merits of the number of complaints received. And I'm wondering if there's a reason, and I think there is, but if you would tell me again, I'd appreciate it.
You are correct, because a complaint is closed does not necessarily mean the complaint was substantiated. Generally, when a complaint is received, we evaluate the statements in the complaint. The investigation consists of determining if there's a factual basis for those allegations, and then if that is true, if the allegations are true, if the alleged conduct would violate any kind of city criteria, be it a policy and procedure, a city code. I hope, does that answer that first part about what constitutes a closed complaint?
They're mingled.
Correct. Closed
as
complaints.
As it relates to substantiated, unsubstantiated are both inside the closed category.
Correct. And then in our quarterly reports and annual reports, it breaks down or breaks out, the closed complaints that resulted in corrective or preventive action by a department. And there is usually a table in our quarterly reports or a chart showing which percentage of complaints that were closed led to a department taking corrective or preventive action.
Or even, and so whether or not the department moves on the recommendation of the whistleblower office, the controller's office, is somewhat outside your control. But at least you can measure accurately the number of recommendations that were made measured against the overall complaints. Where you said to the department, we've done an investigation pursuant to the authority, and we have had findings of wrongdoing, and we recommend disciplinary action to department, whatever it may be. And those can be measured, correct?
Correct.
And are they?
I think the statistics you're asking for, the way that we try and address that, is, like I said, is by publishing in our reports, our publicly issued reports, which percentage of complaints closed, investigated and closed, resulted in some corrective or preventive action by the departments.
Yeah.
And then yes, those are published in our annual reports. Yes.
In the annual report,
As well as quarterly. Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
So I think going forward, when something that we can do that will help the committee and help the dialogue that we will have across the podium is pull some of those stats in our presentation, just so that we can focus some attention on those in a more public forum. But definitely all of that work is published on our website, either annually or quarterly.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Is there any public comment? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing none?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Okay.
so fast.
Good morning, committee members. I'm Dr. Derek Kerr, a whistleblower. I'd like to thank committee member Carlson for his inquiry about complaints that linger for a year or more. I have a complaint filed with the program, and it's well over 11 months, very close to a year. I'd like to echo Mr. Flaherty's concern that when complaints linger for a long time, people tend to think that they're not being taken seriously. That's true. But there's another concern. The vast majority of these complaints are sent right back to the department that the complaint was filed against. And given human nature, there's going to be resistance and reluctance to investigate one's own colleagues, particularly when it's a high-level official, which is what my complaint was about. So I don't know how to resolve this, except that the program outlines certain reasons why complaints take a long time, but they never mention the awkwardness and resistance that departments face when they have to investigate their own people. One thing that would be helpful is if a complaint drags on for a year or more, that the complainant would be contacted and informed. We check on the computer, and all it tells you is under investigation, but why for a year? So anyway, I just wanted to put that out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kerr. Any other public comment? If not, call the next item.
Item 7, opportunity for committee members to comment or take action on any matters within the committee's jurisdiction. Madam Co-Chair, item 1 is the fiscal year 2017-18 work initiatives, and those are items A through G.
Yeah, I can give some background on those. Brenda and I met with Peg to go over some of the great ideas that have come up over the last few meetings about either ways to improve our processes or ways to get information out to our voters. And so we finally decided to write them all down in one place. And Peg has agreed to give us updates on all of them at every meeting so we can sort of understand the progress of these good ideas.
Probably better to do it from here. Peg Stevenson for the Comptroller's Office. And I'll just make very brief comments on each of the items and answer any questions you might have. The benchmarking work is well underway. We've chosen jurisdictions. A couple of them are here in the city of San Francisco. There's a couple of other cities in the country that have similar functionality. We've gathered basic information and we're doing interviews. We expect to issue a report before the end of the calendar year and to have this available for presentation to you in your January meeting. So that's where we are with the benchmarking. The standardized template, I paged through the Department of Public Works current standardized template, which is reflected in the streets bond report that you received last quarter, and compared it to the material that was in our annual GO bond report that David Weinzimmer presented on in September. And the table that I included in your packet has differences between them. I guess my suggestions here are that the same information is largely in both. There isn't a substantial schedule or report that you're not getting in your quarterlies that was in our annual. I do think that there are some visual and layout improvements that the quarterly would benefit from, just looking at it and looking at some of the ways the information is presented, the crowding, the sort of changes in format and that kind of thing. There are consistency improvements that could certainly be made across the programs, you know, so that you're not seeing progress information reported one way in one program and a different way in the next. And then finally, there are some visuals like that could be added to the quarterly that would improve it. For example, there are visual graphs for progress that were in our annual bond program report, like the little fuel gauge graph on completions for some of the bond program components that I think are mostly being presented in text right now. So they're doing bullet points of text completions and that kind of thing. So what I'm proposing to do is I'll meet with Julia Dawson, who's the finance and admin budget program manager at the Department of Public Works, and the person who is really the owner of the quarterly template. I'll talk to her about these things and see if we can just go ahead with some of the simple graphical and visual improvements that we're observing and fold them into the next couple of programs that come before you. There's detail in the quarterlies that isn't in our wrap-up bond program report, change orders, for example, that you wouldn't want to not have. So it's, you know, not entirely a one-way street. But so let me have that meeting with Julia and also see where they are on having updated financials, as we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And then we can report to you on improvements.
Just one quick question. I want to make sure on this report where it says Public Works quarterly report template, yep. is that the detailed quarterly report, or is it the report that they do for the presentation? They're two separate reports.
Yep.
I just want to make sure we're talking about the same.
The report that they do for the presentations, there's more detailed schedules in those quarterlies that aren't present. There wasn't anything to compare it to in our GO bond wrap-up report.
So the analysis table, here is based on the presentation report, not the quarterly report.
Right.
Okay.
So I guess the short version is I have more work to do on this. I think that consistency across the bond programs and a little bit of visual improvement will go a long way towards increasing your happiness with the quarterlies.
Thank you for doing that.
Website improvements. Ben and Maura and our technical person have met to talk about this. And we have similar improvements that are wanted to some of the other sections of the controller's own website. I think what will happen next is that there'll be we're probably going to get a short contract through the tech store, so we just have a web designer who will do a better job for us. If there are test formats that we think you should look at before we publish them, we can certainly do that with you, but probably mostly we'll be making these improvements and then reporting them to you. The satisfaction survey, we have a pool of providers who do public satisfaction, all different kinds of surveying. We use them for polling. We use them for the city survey. We've just reissued this RFQ. The pool will be complete, so new providers will be available to us in a couple of weeks. And then what we're planning to do is to bring you a couple of options at your January meeting. So our conversation was a little bit of feedback from you on what you want your public satisfaction survey to contain. Do you want to try and test the opinion of users of a facility, voters, the general public? There are probably a couple of different possible constituencies that you might be interested in. There are different ways to test. There are intercept surveys where you're in the facility that people are using, you know, handing them a survey and asking them. Phone polls, web polls, different sampling approaches. We have some opinions about this, and our providers will have some opinions too. So again, what I'm proposing to do is bring you a couple of options in January and then see if it gets some feedback from you. Ben's suggestion, you know, he has in mind a streetscape improvement project and then a relatively small sort of facility capital project like a rec center. I think I can speak for him in saying he thinks that those would be a good, appropriately scaled test of opinion, and we kind of know how to survey the users of those things well. A voter opinion thing is probably a little bit harder, but we can, again, do some thinking about it and bring you some options. The public finance forward calendar, You got the memo, which Jamie K. Rubin here prepared, and so that'll be a regular feature of your packet going forward. It's right. Already proved its usefulness, I think. Expenditure audits are underway, and actually before Tanya leaves the room, I don't know off the top of my head when they're expected to be completed, certainly not for January reporting, but for one of your following meetings this fiscal year.
It will be third and fourth quarter.
Great. Thank you.
And then finally, the GO bond report is on this list. We didn't talk about that specifically, but just to keep it on our calendar.
Yep. Awesome. Any comments, questions about all this massive amount of work? Thank you, Peg. Yeah, okay. Oh. Okay.
We'll get some. Solicit some.
Other matters?
Other matters that weren't in that list.
I think we all got this in the mail. Did you guys sign?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you go over quickly what it is we're signing here? Thank you for sending it out.
So the item that co-chair Vice Chu is referring to is the harassment policy education from the city that is due by the end of the year for those commissioners who supervise city staff. And so this committee does not supervise any city staff, and so you were given instructions via email and in guidelines as to how to complete and submit that form to me.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Any other matters? Great. Have a good holiday. We are adjourned.
Thank you. All right.